The following Rarecast podcast is made possible through support from the Global Genes Corporate Alliance. The members of the Corporate Alliance support Global Genes' mission and programs, work to meet the vital needs of people with rare diseases, and address inequities they face. To learn more about the Corporate Alliance or how your organization can become a member, join us at globalgenes.org and choose Corporate Alliance under the About tab. I'm Daniel Levine, and this is Rarecast. Astellas Pharma took a big step into gene therapies when it announced an agreement at the end of 2019 to acquire Audentes Therapeutics for $3 billion. The company continues to build on that acquisition and has just completed construction on a 154,000-square-foot state-of-the-art cell and gene therapy facility to bring together teams dispersed across 20 locations. We spoke to Ha Tran, medical head of cell and gene therapy for Astellas, about the company's vision for cell and gene therapies, its efforts to restart trials for its X-linked myotubular myopathy gene therapy, and how it's looking to other programs beyond that. Ha, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're going to talk about gene therapies, the challenges with developing these therapies for small populations with progressive conditions, and the work of Astellas Gene Therapies. Perhaps we can go back a few years. Astellas made a big move into gene therapies when it announced a $3 billion acquisition of Audentes at the end of 2019. What was the thinking driving the acquisition?
Yes, so the acquisition of Audentes represented a key step in the expansion of the Astellas focus area approach. So this is an approach where Astellas strives to create innovative medicines for diseases with high unmet medical needs, and by identifying unique combinations of biology and therapeutic modality based on emerging science. So with the acquisition of Audentes, the company added a primary focus area in genetic regulation, under which gene therapy is a key driver of the company's future growth. So the complementary capabilities and resources of the two organizations of Audentes and Astellas would create an industry-leading gene therapy company.
Astellas is a large, well-established commercial biopharma with about 15,000 people headquartered in Japan. Audentes, based in San Francisco, had just under 100 employees at the time it was acquired. It's operating as a wholly owned subsidiary. The company was acquiring not just the programs, but people with important expertise that could walk out the door. To what extent has Astellas been protective of the culture of Audentes, or blended it with Astellas, or remade it?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, Audentes had been relatively independent for some time following the acquisition back in 2019. But, you know, with legacy Audentes leaders departing, which naturally occurs following acquisitions, there was a natural desire to integrate, and it happened quite slowly over time. So in that sense, the Audentes culture has been well preserved. It was very natural for many employees to start referring to themselves as AGT or Astellas Gene Therapy shortly after the acquisition. I think the biggest challenge was for employees to start calling themselves Astellas versus AGT. We have a mix of team members who have been with Audentes since 2017 when the company formed, some who joined right during the acquisition or shortly after when Audentes became AGT. And then, you know, more recently, people like myself who are what we call legacy Astellas employees who started to join the gene therapy program. So it's been a nice blend, and the culture and vibe is unique and distinctive within the company, and that's quite special. And, you know, just to shed a little bit of light on it. So, you know, mainly you can think of, you know, the people working on gene therapy as West Coasters. So you have the South San Francisco biotech mover and shaker mentality, the people who love rare diseases and are driven by passion and really just huge advocates to get things done for rare disease populations have very limited therapies in place.
The company just completed construction on a 154,000 square foot state-of-the-art facility in South San Francisco. This will be the West Coast hub for cell and gene therapy research and bring together what's now been more than 20 geographically dispersed teams. Are you opened yet? Is it officially open? And how do you see that changing the way the company operates?
Yeah, we actually had our soft opening at the end of December. You know, since I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, I've been coming in every week or so, you know, sometimes multiple days a week. But the grand opening will be in May. It's an absolutely gorgeous state-of-the-art space that comes with great lighting, plenty of parking, open space, as well as plenty of conference room and private workspace that allows for collaboration as well as one-on-one meetings. And, you know, it's super exciting. I think the deal sealer is the plethora of parking, as we know, can be limited in the Bay Area, especially in San Francisco. And I've noticed people coming into the office more since December, before the development and research teams were scattered. So most of the development and business strategy folks were coming into the city while the research teams were spread across like three different buildings in South San Francisco. So now being under one roof really enhances our connectivity. You know, we have now larger size lecture style room so that we can give and listen to talks and boardroom style conference rooms, which is effective for, you know, external business meetings. So all in all, this complements our end-to-end infrastructure capabilities with manufacturing GMP compliant drug substance and drug product materials, you know, our ability to commercially scale our manufacturing capabilities, the ability to perform quality control testing with our lab space and warehousing for our pipeline of our AAV gene therapy programs and studies, which can all be done in parallel. So I'm not sure if you're also aware that we have a 135,000 square foot manufacturing facility in Sanford, North Carolina that was completed in 2022. So this is a GMP compliant facility that also expands our Astellas manufacturing capabilities.
At a time when development stage biotechs are being so protective of their cash and doing what they can to extend the runway, I take it it's also a reminder on the upside of being acquired by a large biopharmaceutical company.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think that's a big hurdle for some small biotech gene therapy companies. So it's nice to have this wealth of capabilities that we are so fortunate to have.
The company's lead gene therapy in development is AT132, a gene therapy for X-linked myotubular myopathy. For listeners not familiar with the condition, what is it?
Yeah, X-linked myotubular myopathy is also known shortly as XLMTM, or, you know, some groups will also call it MTM, is a serious life-threatening rare neuromuscular disease. And it's characterized by extreme muscle weakness, respiratory failure, and early death. So overall, the mortality rates are estimated to be approximately 50% in the first 18 months of life. Now that's without any sort of therapeutic intervention. And for patients who do survive past infancy, approximately 75% will live to the age of 10. It's caused by a mutation in the MTM1 gene, and that leads to a lack or dysfunction of myotubularin, which is a protein that is needed for normal development, maturation, and function of skeletal muscle cells. It's a rare disease, and it affects approximately 1 in 40 to 50,000 newborn males.
How does the condition manifest itself and progress?
So the specific symptoms and severity of XLMTM can vary from one person to another. However, the majority of individuals with XLMTM have severe presentation. So one classification subdivides XLMTM into different forms. So there's a severe classic form, which is what Astellas is developing a gene therapy for. And then there are also less common moderate or mild forms. In the severe form, the affected male infants exhibit extreme muscle weakness and hypotonia or floppiness shortly after birth. So these are the patients who have really weak muscles, and that affects their ability to breathe and swallow. So they have problems like breathing and feeding difficulties shortly after birth or right at birth. And it's really noticeable. And these patients are usually have really low Apgar scores, or it becomes a medical emergency in the neonatal ICUs, and they will need intervention to stay alive. So those interventions include putting in a breathing tube initially and eventually converting over to a tracheostomy to allow for ventilation, and then insertion of a gastrostomy tube for feeding. These infants typically stay in the hospital for approximately 3 months of their life. So they continue to have this usually for lifelong. And, you know, if they do survive the infancy period, they typically will be ventilator feeding and wheelchair dependent.
And for those who survive, are there treatment options, and what's the prognosis?
Sure. So, you know, it's actually the treatment options are symptomatic, right? And so for breathing, again, as I mentioned, it's respiratory therapy, dependency on a ventilator, you know, and all the medications that come with that, but it doesn't change or reverse their condition. For the feeding difficulties, that is G2 feedings, you know, nutritionists or dietitians can help with to meet some of those dietary demands, which these patients will have more of because of the need to, you know, use artificial ventilation. And physical therapy can be helpful. However, you know, for prolonged periods of time that you're not able to sit, stand, or walk, you know, it does take a toll on your the architecture, right? And so a lot of these patients may have scoliosis, contractures, and whatnot. So, you know, with artificial ventilation over time, you know, these patients can be subject to life-threatening infections such as pneumonia, that could become either antibiotic resistance or antifungal resistant, et cetera. So, you know, that you can put a big dent on their, not just their mortality, but also their quality of life. These patients also have what's reported in the literature as something called pleiosis of the liver. So abnormal vascular formations in the liver that can cause life-threatening liver bleeds as well.
What's AT132 and how does it work?
So it's a gene therapy. And to back up, I can briefly explain how AAV-based gene therapies work. So that's adeno-associated virus-based gene therapies. So these are a method to treat patients if you have a missing or dysfunctional gene. In general, it's difficult to insert DNA into cells. So AAV is used as a vector to direct DNA into cells, and the genome of the AAV is replaced with the functional copy of the gene that is missing or dysfunctional. So that comes as a transgene. And once the functional gene is delivered into the cell's nucleus, the AAV is broken down, and the single-stranded DNA transgene is copied to form double-stranded DNA. And then the therapeutic transgene is converted into an episome. So this remains separate from the patient's genomic DNA, so it doesn't alter or integrate into the patient's genome. But the transgene now provides information to the cells to produce the functional protein. So in XLMTM, the myotubularin is the protein that is required for normal development and for normal function of skeletal muscle. So that's, again, missing or not functional in XLMTM. So AT132 is comprised of an AAV8 capsid that carries that functional copy of the MTM gene designed to express the myotubulin protein. And it's used under a muscle-specific promoter called desmin. So after the gene transfer, the MTM1 gene produces functional myotubularin. So that has the potential to improve the respiratory and motor development, right? And that hopefully leads to increased function and improved survival.
This is a program that has been on a clinical hold since late 2021. There were a total of 4 patients in the clinical study who had died. More recently, a publication in the journal Lancet Neurology has shed some light on what happened to the patients in the study who died and how the other patients in the study have fared. What's now known about the therapy?
Yes, so we've been updating the health authorities, scientific community, and patient groups about the status of the program, you know, and high-level results of the study data to date. The Lancet Neurology article allows for a much more detailed look into the details, and it's also peer-reviewed. So the article itself is really well done. It has a lot of appendices for people who really want to dig into data. But what's new here, or what is more informative, is that it highlights the commonalities of the clinical trial participants who experienced the hepatobiliary serious adverse events. So 4 out of the 4 participants who died and 4 out of 5 participants with a serious adverse events of the hepatobiliary abnormalities did show that they had some abnormal liver or gallbladders prior to dosing with AT132. On the flip side, the journal article also highlights the transformational promise that many patients and families hope for, such as meeting ventilatory and motor milestones that are not typically observed in the natural history. So more than half of the participants dosed with gene therapy achieved ventilator independence, meaning they came off the ventilator. So this is something that is, again, not seen typically in the natural history. And then 8 out of 24 participants dosed were able to walk independently versus none in the control group. And aside from walking independently, which is like a huge feat, sitting independently for 30 seconds and pulling to stand were also seen more frequently in participants dosed with AT132 compared to control. So these are quite remarkable, as again, it's not seen with the symptomatic care that I've discussed previously, like with respiratory therapy, physical therapy, feeding therapy. You wouldn't expect to see these types of improvements in your respiratory or your motor milestones.
One of the challenges with this therapy is the need to deliver high doses of it. You've also identified that the patients who died all had progression of disease to the liver. Is Astellas planning any changes for the study or the patient selection criteria?
Sure, yes. Well, you know, we have been looking into enrichment of the investigational product. And, you know, this is in line with industry trends and a desire from Astellas to constantly improve the product quality. You know, the desire to further remove empty capsids from our investigational product and thus reducing the total capsid load, which gives the ability to reduce the total dose. You know, the development of a new clinical protocol is something that we're continuing to discuss internally as well as with our stakeholders, including the health authorities, the principal investigators, our KOLs, and the patient community. So, you know, we continue to review the non-clinical and clinical data and to help identify the study population with a lower risk for these type of hepatobiliary cholestatic events after AAV gene therapy.
Where is Astellas in regards to discussions with regulators on starting up the trial again?
So we initially submitted our responses back in 2022, and we did also submit a clinical hold response last March, so in March of 2023. The hold remains in place to date, and as stated before, you know, we continue to work through the complexities of the protocol and the program and continue to interact with the health authorities and the patient and scientific community.
In June 2023, the company entered into a licensing deal with Kate Therapeutics for KT-430, a next-generation XLMTM gene therapy. What makes this next generation?
Sure. Yeah. So AT132, our current technology in which this viral study was described in the Lancet Neurology publication, is designed to deliver the functional copy of human MTM1 gene with AAV8, right, as previously described. So KT-430 is next generation, meaning that it is expected to deliver a functional copy of an MTM1 gene via a novel MyoAAV capsid. So it's an engineered AAV capsid. So more specifically, MyoAAV is a new group of adeno-associated viruses, and it uses a modified outer protein shell of AAV, known as the capsid, to deliver genetic therapies with greater efficiency and lower doses. So there's an article that was published in the journal Cell in 2021, and the data shows that in mouse models of Duchenne muscular dystrophy and X-linked myotubular myopathy, the MyoAAV demonstrated more efficient delivery of the gene therapy and gene editing payloads. So their preclinical data resulted in complete restoration of muscle function and improved survival. And also in the preclinical data from non-human primates, they also did a comparison between the natural AAV serotypes. And what they showed or reported was that MyoAAV delivered 25 to 50 times greater gene expression in multiple skeletal muscles and 10 to 15 times greater gene expression in cardiac muscle. So they demonstrated the ability to reduce delivery to the liver by 50%, and showed lower accumulation of the transgene in the liver. That's really encouraging news, because what you can expect is to be able to dose at a log lower, and then also to have increased efficiency. So all in all, it's really the hope that you can deliver the functional copy of the gene at a log lower dose with greater efficiency.
This is a preclinical program. Would the expectation be that this would replace AT-132? Would you use it as a backup, or would you move them both as fast as you can?
Yeah, I mean, it's this licensing agreement is an important opportunity for Astellas to demonstrate our ongoing commitment to developing therapies for XLMTM. And so I think this really demonstrates our commitment to this patient and caregiver community. And I think it's also important us to invest in newer AAV capsids that can potentially help bring benefits to patients at lower doses that can be achieved with naturally occurring serotypes.
So, do you think you'll develop both programs, or do you expect the newer program to replace the existing one?
That's a great question, and I think that's a lot of as stated before, the licensing agreement, the data currently only exist in the preclinical model. So there's a lot of assessment that need to be done internally before having even beginning to evaluate that specific situation.
Astellas has a number of other programs in development, including ones for Pompe disease, Friedreich's ataxia, and myotonic dystrophy. What has the company learned about developing gene therapies from its experiences to date, and are there challenges you've learned to address through the XLMTM program that you're applying to the other programs?
Yeah, absolutely. We're extra conscientious about balancing risk and benefits. The starting dose for any new programs, the decision to dose escalate, and when are all topics we take very seriously and have hearty debates about. Expanding your selection criteria is also something that we think carefully about. Most companies start enrolling patients who meet a very narrow and specific inclusion/exclusion criteria. But as time goes on, many companies are tempted to loosen that criteria to speed up enrollment. And when we do that, there's always a risk that the new participants may not respond in the same manner as previous ones. And that can lead to either a safety risk or a risk where the efficacy won't be the same. For example, if the disease has progressed too much, or if the disease is not severe enough yet to detect a clinical meaningful benefit. So we've gained the ability to have more standardized approach to assessing the situation and gathering key stakeholder input to help gather information so that we can make an informed decision. And I think that's really, before we make a decision, it's important to get the opinions of our investigators, our key opinion leaders, external committees, and patient groups to really help us with that.
And what have you learned about working with the patient community through the program?
Well, you know, they are our biggest stakeholders, and, you know, much of what we are doing, or all of what we are doing, is for the patients and the families. And so what we've learned is, you know, they really like to hear from us, and often. And, you know, we need to remember that for some of us, you know, some of us, it's work. But for them, it's their livelihood, their families, their children, their future. So when we think, oh, we just met with them last month, you know, it may seem like years to them. And so if we don't have an update that we can share, just for them to see us on video, to know that we're here, we're working, we care, and I think that does help a little bit. I know the families are always wanting to find out additional information. They want to know what it means for them and their family. They want to know the timelines. They want to know when we'll be back in clinic. Will we be back in clinic in time for their loved ones? So there's quite a bit of education that needs to be provided on behalf of the sponsor, and really setting or resetting expectations to do as well. You know, drug development is really challenging, even for your common, everyday, run-of-the-mill family doctor, right? So they may not know what it takes to bring a drug to market. So if that's the case, you know, there's just so much more education and, you know, close discussion that needs to be done with the patient community.
Ha Tran, Medical Head of Cell and Gene Therapy for Astellas Pharma. Ha, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Gianni. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. For more information about rare disease and to connect to the rare disease community, go to globalgenes.org. To keep up on the latest news and trends affecting the rare disease community, be sure to visit raredaily.org. You can subscribe to the Rarecast RSS feed through raredaily.org or through SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast manager. The Rarecast is produced for Global Genes by the Levine Media Group. You can also find our podcast, The Bio Report, on these popular podcast sites. Our theme music is composed by Jonah Levine and performed by the Jonah Levine Collective. We'd love to hear from you. Drop us a note at danny@levinemediagroup.com.